Motiversity family, it's Marcus Taylor, and I want to thank you for tuning in to the Motivation Daily Podcast by Motiversity, one of the top 50 podcasts in the world. If you enjoy listening to Motiversity and this podcast, you need to download the Mindset Daily Motivation app. On it, you'll gain access to thousands of motivational speeches, including Motiversity's and mine. And now, with the new Mindset Alarm feature, you can start each day with purpose, waking up to powerful audios like this one.
You may be average, you may be ordinary, but you have the opportunity every single day to make extraordinary decisions. And what you do today will determine your future.
To download Mindset, just go to mindsetapp.com or search for Mindset Daily Motivation on the Apple or Google Play Store and listen to motivational speeches while getting ready for the day. Click the link to download Mindset now and get ready to transform your life.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
We have a rather ambivalent attitude to science at present. We have come to expect a steady increase in the standard of living that science and technology have brought, but people distrust science because they don't understand it or feel they can control it. The popularity of science fiction like Star Trek is because this is a form of science with which people feel safe. But an understanding of science fact would lay their fears to rest much better. What can be done to harness this fascination with science and give people the background they need to make informed decisions on subjects like the greenhouse effect, nuclear weapons, or genetic engineering? The basis must be what is taught in schools. But school science is often presented in a dry and uninteresting manner. When I wrote a brief history, I was advised that each equation I included would have the sales. I included one, Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared. Perhaps I would have sold twice as many copies without it. Scientists and engineers tend to express their ideas by equations because they need to know the precise value of quantities. But for most people, a qualitative, rather than quantitative, understanding is sufficient. This can be conveyed by words and diagrams without the need for complicated equations. School science can provide the basic framework. but the rate of progress is now so rapid that there are always new developments that have occurred since one was at school or university. Popular science books and articles can help to put across these new developments. But only a small proportion of the population reads even the most successful book. Television is one way to reach a truly mass audience. But television is communication one way only. Now, with the internet, people can answer back and interact. In a way, the internet connects us all together, like the neurons in a giant brain. With such an IQ, what won't we be capable of? So remember to look up at the stars and not down at your feet. Try to make sense of what you see, and wonder about what makes the universe exist. Be curious. And however difficult life may seem, there is always something you can do and succeed at. It matters that you don't just give up. Thank you for listening.
If you could make a phone call to the 20-year-old Chris, what would you tell him?
Zero, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff.
I think what might have been worthwhile to explain to myself at 20 is to recognize that every single person you meet is struggling. I didn't know that then. You tend to see other people as completely formed individuals. I still do sometimes. But to recognize that everybody you meet, every single one of them, no matter how expensive their suit is or how serious their expression is, they are looking for significance. They are trying to do the best they can, and they fail regularly. And they're you know, within their own particular battle of their own life. And so cut them some slack for that. Don't let them off the hook. But recognize the shared nature of being a human being, and let people be themselves, make some allowances for them, treat people a little more kindly as a result.
Thumbs up from Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield returning from his command of the International Space Station.
I've been hugely lucky, and I think we collectively are more liable to make good decisions for ourselves and for where we live, the more clearly we can see the whole thing as one place.
And you started posting these pictures on a whim, really, taking these beautiful photographs from up in space because you see so many.
Well, picture what it's like. You're there, yeah, with a camera and you're going around the world and you float over to the window and you say, I'm not even going to take a picture today. I just want to look at the world. And you're looking at something, you go, holy, and you got to grab the camera because there's your emotions are trapped behind you. You can't keep up. And you go, I got to take a picture of this so I can look at it later. Responsibility that comes with being trusted with being an astronaut, I think, it's been delightful to see the effect of it. I took 45,000 pictures over my 3 space flights. And after a year, I got back from landing. I was like, what are we going to do with all those photos? I mean, do we just let them sit in a file? I thought, why don't we take the best and put them in a book and then put why each picture meant something to me. This is just a sharing of the experience and let people then maybe see the world for what it truly is, or at least a slightly clearer view or a more complete perspective-rich view of the world. And then, just like me as a 9-year-old boy, maybe they will then be a slightly different person with their choices. Hopefully we're all students of the human condition, whether we mean to be or not. And as we get a little older, we gain a little perspective. I think what we're truly getting at is a collective understanding of where we are and what it means. And the where we are is the part that we can share the best. What it means is an individual choice. But the more people you meet, the more you understand what battles people are fighting, the more you see the commonality of the human experience itself. But then the real question, of course, is if you do feel that maybe something has enlightened you a little bit, or if you've had a thought that most people have not, do you just have a secret smile? Or do you try and maybe share it with someone you love, or write it down, or take a picture? And I think shared understanding is what empowers us more than anything. To try and actually see the world in its totality, it's virtually impossible. Maybe we can see, a documentary program, or we can read a travel book, or we can look at a coffee table book, or we'll get on an airplane and go somewhere and go somewhere else, and you start to piece together some of the threads of the fabric that is our actual planet. But I've been lucky enough to take sort of the best of our transportation technology that we've ever invented, and to get on board a ship and go around the world in 92 minutes, to go around the world 100 times and then 1,000 times. And not just going around the world, but around the world 16 times a day where it turns underneath you. So every circumnavigation is like another voyage of discovery. And the angle between you and the sun and the world, because of your speed, is constantly changing. And the seasons are changing. I went from one side of the sun to the other, right across the solar system while I was on the space station, right around it. So you saw winter and summer swap ends on the world. And so each time around, you see the world slightly more for what it is, more clearly. And somewhere along the way, in one of those thousands of orbits, I think you fundamentally, I don't know if it's shift or deepen or both, but you start to see the world as what it actually is. I feel hugely privileged to without anybody telling me what to think, and without any filters in the way, to actually have seen the whole world over and over and over again until it seeped into me permanently. And it doesn't necessarily give me any outlandish insight or any outlandish imperative to change the world, but I think it does give me a perspective that I feel compelled to try and share, to try and let as many other people. I was there on behalf of a lot of people. You know, it took a lot of lucre to build that rocket ship and accelerate my body to 8 kilometers a second and let me stay there. And so I feel a responsibility to do my best to let other people see what's beyond their room based on the things that I've seen. You can read about a spacewalk or watch a movie of a spacewalk and you sort of get a sense of it. And then when you're on board a spaceship and you're floating weightless by the window, especially we have one bulging window, the cupola, so you can almost freely look around in 180 degrees, you get some sense of where you actually are. But the day that you, for real, are gonna be on the other side of that window and you're gonna assume the danger of it, you're gonna put on this, build this spacesuit around your body, and then go into a tiny bit of the ship and close a hatch behind you. You're gonna become a torpedo. And then take all the air out of that little part you're in, and then open up the hatch, and now actually physically pull yourself on the outside of the ship. That's entirely different. Spent my whole life visualizing it, dreaming about it, talking to guys who'd done it, and then training in virtual reality, training underwater. But suddenly, the part of your body that's in the sun is plus 150 Celsius, and you feel the searing heat of that. And the part of you that's in the shade is minus 140 Celsius. And so when your legs touch the fabric of the inflated suit, it's like growing up on a farm with super cold metal on a stovepipe, and you don't want to let it touch your skin because it's so searingly cold. And you feel the environment that you're in, and the world is silently, you can see an entire face of the whole planet right across a continent, and it's right there beside you, and it's silently turning, and the whole universe is right here, and you're in the middle holding on with one hand. It's extremely visceral and physical and personal and intimate to be in the world that way. As you mentioned at the outset, I flew on the space shuttle twice. Once to go help build the Russian space station Mir, and then on my second flight to go help build the International Space Station and do spacewalks. But on my third flight, you know, this wasn't just a week or two on board the space shuttle. This was launch as the pilot or the bort engineer of the Soyuz and then stay in space for almost half a year. And it's not to belittle those initial shuttle flights. They were magnificent and hugely instructive to me. But I count myself hugely lucky to, at the end of all that, to have had a chance to go live off the planet for 5 months, to be asked to command the spaceship. So that level of seriousness and responsibility, but also just the richness of what comes along with that experience itself. And so you take these pictures, and now you pull the little chip out of the camera, you put it in your zippered up pocket so it doesn't float away. And by the end of the day, you've kind of got a whole bunch of those chips. You got like the whole world in your pocket waiting for you to truly look at it. And there is some magnificent, unexpected, intimate view of the world. And now what do you do with that? And the beauty now of the space station and social media is that I could just go and honestly write what I was thinking and hit send. And then just turn it loose to anybody who might also be curious about the world. And it was delightful to see the reaction, to see how many people, millions by the time we landed, who were also delighting in what that technological invention allows us to see about ourselves.
Our brain constantly changes. Every second is changing, every experience is changing. If I pull your brain out your head, if I did some brain surgery on you right now, which I won't, and I hold your brain in my hand, it's not going to do anything. I can look at it all day long. You dead, nothing in your body will function. No genome, no genetic activation, nothing will happen, no genes will switch on. But the fact that you are alive and I haven't done that, the only reason your brain and genes are doing anything is because of your thinking, feeling, and choosing. It's firing them up. It is the switch on. Your thinking, feeling, and choosing switches your genes on. We own our thinking, feeling, and choosing. And that's the mind, that's the I factor. That's the part that we are not, have not done enough research on, that I've spent 30 years myself researching. We've got to focus on that, because otherwise I can use my brain as an excuse for everything, which is the day and age we live in. You can't make the relationship work. They've got ADHD, that's why they've got this, they've got that, that's why. No, that's not why. Those are effects.
I can be raised in the same household, experience the same challenges, same divorce, same parents, I'm a twin. Everything could be identical, the same experience. Mm-hmm. By 20 years old, I can still view the world in a different way than you.
You've done it from birth. You've done it from birth, totally, totally different. This is why we see studies of identical twins, where you'll have one that's in old age, and one gets Alzheimer's, and one is still firing up and still going along. You know, how you perceive things makes your body work for you or against you. Your mind is moving through your brain. Your brain builds that perception physically into your brain. So you're thinking, feeling, choosing, moment by moment of every day. And if here, if I take a scenario where I'm constantly seeing a negative, so if I have now more than 63 days constantly thought in a certain way, I have built a very strong tree in my brain. A tree is a thought. Our thoughts are real things. They look like trees. They occupy mental real estate. They're made of proteins.
I agree, they're 100%.
They are total. Right now, you are growing at the speed of 400 billion actions. You're converting my words, and so are the listeners, into trees in their brain. But now, if you've got a habit, if you've done something for years, and you've thought in a way for years, because of an experience, because of environment, so there's nurture, you're born with this wired for love design. We're in nurture, environment, and all the other stuff you described. Now there's the I factor. The two twins going through life, same thing, but how they seen it. So each experience is now adding more and more layers to my initial core. So here I am born, but here I am perceiving. I may perceive the two twins. One perceives a relationship in this way, one perceives a situation in this way. Two different networks build in the brain. And as you keep thinking in that certain way, so you strengthen. Whatever you think about the most grows into a toxic thought.
I see
so
that.
That's the pattern.
I fully see that.
You can train a person very easily to stand back, observe their own thinking, because it's neuroscience, it's how we are designed, it's quantum physics, it's all of that. You can stand back and observe your own thinking, and you can show someone, can you see that you're being negative? Can you see that that is, and you can, what so by showing people, there's always a way for someone to see it, but not everyone will choose to do that. So if someone has done something and they've been doing it for more than 63 days, they have wired a pattern into their brain like a pathway. It looks like a toxic tree. That's why I use this. It's a real protein. It's all computers. And those computers have been very, very established. It takes 21 days to build a long-term memory. It takes 63 days minimum to build a habit, not 21 like we've been told, 63. Anything after that, you're going to expert level. So if I have for 6 years been worrying, I'm an expert warrior. It doesn't mean that's who I am. It's who I've become. So I can unbecome. It's hard work. I'm going to have to do a lot of mind work. I'm going to have to do a lot of mind management to use emotional signals like depression and anxiety. And I'm going to have to use that to make, to find out what is the cause of why I'm so negative. Now, even a long-term memory can be reconceptualized. And that means I'll always remember. So let's say, for example, someone sees the glass half empty and they've just been in that. And it's just like, oh, these people just always going to see the negative first. Every business meeting, they just always see the negative. But that person can change. They very well, they become an expert in being negative. But they can actually unwire that. They can get to the point where it's a lot of work. You've got to go through the pain of doing it, which people don't want to in this day and age. But you can change that and reverse that process.
What's the five step?
So the five steps, first of all, is gather.
Gather?
Gather. That's a big word for embrace, acknowledge.
Embrace that you have an issue.
Got to accept there's an issue.
What's the second one?
Second one is you've got to reflect. It's a deep reflection. It's a process. This is the most painful part. It's like a surgeon will say, my friends, I've got a lot of doctor friends, and they'll say that they've got to first cut up the patient to heal them. So you've got to go through the pain before, got to hurt you to heal you. So that's this whole process is hard. I'm not lying, but it's good, mm-hmm. and it takes time. It's going to take cycles of 21 days. So the second process is deep reflection, where you are basically trying to track back to, not necessarily back, but why am I doing this?
Are you studying your trends?
You're looking at your trends, your patterns. Okay. So the first thing is to take, I'm depressed. This is an emotional warning signal. My body's got physical warning signals. Mm-hmm. So you're embracing the emotional and physical warning signals from the environment and from yourself. You're then thinking about these. Okay, so why am I always negative? Or why am I always depressed? Why am I anxious? And as you go through that process of self-reflection, you're getting to the point to the point where you find, okay, well, maybe this is at the end of 21 days. You see, oh, I'm anxious because I'm actually trying to be a perfectionist. I'm trying to control everything in my environment, and it's not quite working out. Or maybe it's because there's a trauma that you've never dealt with. Mm-hmm. The third thing is we've got to genetically process. So what we've got to do is we've got to make our brain do stuff. We've got to write. The third process is write. When you write, you're clearing out a lot of... and when I say write, it's like literally throw it on the page. Because you'll see my sequence that I've developed. You literally spend a minute and a half to 2 minutes doing each of these. So you would gather for a minute and a half. You would reflect for a minute and a half. You would write for a minute and a half. And then you would recheck. Now, recheck is a process where you go back and look for your patterns, your triggers, your what does this mean? So if you think of it, I've become aware of something going on. I am reflecting, why am I feeling? I'm starting to get to the root, because it's only a minute and a half and you must move on. Mm-hmm. You're writing that down. So maybe a bunch of jumble that you write down. Your recheck looks at your jumble and tries to get some level of order. As you get that level of order, you say, okay, what's my little tiny task for today? And it may be as simple as, when I feel this anxiety coming on, I'm going to compartmentalize it, and I'm going to only worry about it tonight at 6 o'clock. But in a minute and a half, there's only a little bit of information you've gathered, which is the point. You must only get a bit every day, not everything every day. We can't solve it all. Rome was not built in a day. It's little things change over time. We try and fix it quick. You can't get there. It's a process. You have to dig it out of your unconscious. It's a deep investigative detective process that you're doing. Mm-hmm. So let's say now that you start seeing, okay, I'm worrying because of this, or I'm negative, and I'm starting to get a glimpse of, well, maybe it could be this, or maybe. So what can I do today? As
so
a little activity, active
activity.
Reach.
Okay.
Activity, active reach.
Got it.
And active reach is then, if I see that, if let's take the worrying thing, I wake up and I'm worrying. It's like the day I'm stuck. It's getting, so I say, okay, I'm aware that I'm worrying. All I've worked out today, it's day one. I've just worked out that I actually never stop worrying. So cool. What's my active reach? As that hits me in the face, I'm going to say, okay, this worry I can't deal with now. I'm going to deal with tonight. So now it's 6 o'clock in the morning. I'll deal with it 6 o'clock tonight. As you go through the day,
your worries.
It is that, but also what happens is you take the energy away from the worry. Every thought you build is a real living thing. It has energy. It's firing energy. So if I take this worry, toxic, and I say, okay, keep quiet. You're in a box. I'm not going to deal with you. And you discipline yourself not to think about it. And by the time 6 o'clock tonight comes, 12 hours later, that thing's lost energy. Back in the 80s, I was trained that the brain couldn't change. I challenged that. I did work with people that had traumatic brain injury, like major, that had been written off by neurologists and neurosurgeons. And through deliberate and intentional building of the brain, learning, growing the brain, studying daily, went back to university, ended up finishing school, getting high grades. And this kid had been written off as a vegetable. And I've seen that happen way too often. Not just me, there's many scientists who have since shown that when you use your mind, your brain will change.
Let's learn how to work our machinery a little
right.
bit.
You know? I agree. We don't, in this culture, teach people how to operate their mind and body.
How do you get motivated? Well, one way to do that is if you are good at subjectively attaching dopamine to the pursuit, just knowing, okay, I really am hungry for this. I'm going to tell myself that, you know, making it 1% of the way is a success, and I'm going to keep going, and I'm going to keep ratcheting on. And then the other aspect of it is that anytime that we're leaning into action, it has the possibility of being an amplifying process or a depleting process. And the key to that is making sure that you're balancing the dopamine and epinephrine systems.
We have to remember that this mechanism of dopamine and pathfinding to goals is in every animal, humans, dogs, sheep. So a grazing animal might be on a really barren landscape. They go some direction and they don't smell water, which animals can do. And so they veer off course, and then all of a sudden they get a little bit of scent of water. At that point, that's when the dopamine is released, not when they get the water and drink from it. So that puts them in energy to get there. You know, you think about walking in the desert and you're just dying of thirst, and all of a sudden you spot a big lake. All of a sudden, you will have the energy to run the remaining mile, whereas before you thought you were going to die. How is that? It's not like more glycogen is suddenly available. It's not like ketones did it for you. So what did it? That's dopamine. That's dopamine release that says there's a reward waiting for me.
And I would say finally, in 2020, we finally as a field got a clear idea of how dopamine is really working. If you can start to register, that craving and that friction and that desire, that almost kind of low level of agitation, sometimes high level of agitation, that is that I'm trying to impose my will on the world in a benevolent way, we hope, that's dopamine. It's working with its close cousin, which is epinephrine, which is adrenaline. They are very close cousins. In fact, dopamine manufactures epinephrine. A lot of people don't know this, but adrenaline is actually made from the molecule dopamines. Okay, so those two are hanging out together. It's like crave, work, crave, work, crave and work, crave and work, crave and work. And then you get the win. And some people allow the big peak in dopamine to be associated with the win. And smart people learn to adjust their celebration internally, right? This is all internal. You could throw the biggest party in the world, but as long as you're kind of laid back and looking at this, not letting yourself get manic crazy, you won't necessarily crash as hard, and pretty soon your system will reset. So you take the day, you clean up the dishes, you relax, you go, what now? I'm feeling a little low. Well, rather than going out and spiking your dopamine again, just wait. Understand that the scale will reset again. Give yourself a few days where you're going to feel a little kind of underwhelmed. Things aren't going to be as interesting. It's going to be hard to trigger that big release because you just had the peak. Well, if you adjust that, you relax, you understand there's always a little bit of a postpartum depression. We sometimes hear about postpartum depression. That's a clinical thing. But there's always that kind of, today's not as exciting as the previous days. What am I going to do with my life? But then if you let it start ratcheting up again, then what you realize is your capacity to tap into dopamine as a motivator, not just seeking dopamine rewards, that is infinite. And I can say with great certainty that this is how you were able to build a big company and sell it, how you've been able to build a successful podcast and sell it, how you're constantly seeking, because seeking is the reward. And I think for most people, we think of the reward as the finish line. And so the key is to get to the finish line, step into the end zone, but no end zone dance. It's just like, yep, and now I'm gonna go do it again.
How we view the world is shaping the release of these chemicals. And I do believe this happens when we have positive thoughts. We get a lift. If we can get a lift from our positive thoughts, and then dopamine itself puts us in relationship with the outside world such that we view the outside world as having more possibility, that is going to put us into forward momentum. Mm. There are a lot of studies to support that. The key with positive thinking is that it has to be honest. It can't be, I've already won, you know, I don't have an Olympic gold medal. If I could tell myself I'm going to get one tomorrow, but I just don't have the skills. Mm-hmm. So that's not going to release dopamine in my system. The key thing is that you can't just be all gas pedal all the time without rewarding yourself. It's mental energy. It's the desire to push on. It's the mm-hmm. desire to keep going.
And so again, we need some consistent dopamine hits throughout the days or our months
right.
to give us more energy to pursue.
That's right.
But we don't want to be over-pursued because then we'll burn out.
That's right. And so everyone has to find where that Man. Sweet spot is. There's a lot of interest these days in like habits and habit formation. Mm-hmm. Because when you move that horizon in close and you complete something small, it's not about what you completed, it's the fact that you completed. So one thing to understand is that dopamine release in the brain is always subjective. There's no experience that says, that has unique domain over dopamine release, that will only allow dopamine release. So if it's very subjective. So if I say to myself, I'm going to get into the process of doing something. We have a new year coming up, so there's going to be a lot of resolutions soon. If you attach the dopamine release to the process of effort or goal setting itself, you'll have more energy to be in effort. And then if you can attach dopamine release to the belief that you're at least heading in the right direction, you'll have more energy to keep going in the right direction. People make the mistake of thinking that the positive thought process should be attached to the finish line. It's not about thinking you've already won. It's not about being delusional. It's about thinking that your training is going to take you to the finish line. And so it's about moving that mental horizon in more closely, and then triggering some sort of positive internal representation of what you're doing, meaning thinking positive. And people, this is usually where I get stopped, and people say, wait, but it sounds so subjective. Tell me exactly how to do it. But here's the key point. It's supposed to be subjective. Everyone needs to figure out what allows them to continue to be in forward momentum, what allows them to constrain the world of possibilities and to go after goals, and how often to self-reward. But the key is the self word, because if you start only pursuing external rewards, that's when you are no longer in control of your dopamine system. Make sure that that reward, really bask in it, really appreciate what you've done and what's come to you. But take that feeling of being saturated with dopamine, the huge win, and attach it to the effort process that got you there.